This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Why would anyone want the job of U.S. president? There's a question. We're going to test the reluctance of one of the latest darlings of the conservative movement later this hour, Dr. Ben Carson. You'll want to stay tuned for that. Also, avoiding trauma or avoiding reality. Colleges grapple with the issue of trigger warnings to alert students to upsetting content in the classroom. And the pattern of legalizing gay marriage and other signs of the acceptance of the LGBT community in the United States is a very different environment from the systematic ways in which gays were excluded from public life just a few decades ago. Later this hour, we'll look at the story told in archived documents recently brought to light. But we begin with the U.S. involvement in another conflict zone. 80 U.S. troops heading to a base in Chad in Central Africa to join the fight against the Nigerian Boko Haram terror group holding hundreds of schoolgirls hostage since their kidnapping in Nigeria last month. The troops will set up an Air Force base for Predator surveillance drones and share that intelligence with Nigerian troops who say they may be closing in on the site where the girls are being held. What are the risks and capabilities here? Dr. Jeff Porter is assistant professor with the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, founder of North Africa Risk Consulting Incorporated, a consulting firm specializing in political and security risks in North Africa. Dr. Porter, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. How are you?
Great. So let's talk about the capabilities of Predator drones here. And your familiarity is North Africa. It's a slightly different terrain in Nigeria, but I'm sure you understand what is possible here.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the deployment of the drones in Chad will be principally to gain what is called ISR, Intelligence Surveillance Reconnaissance Information. Now, it's going to be difficult because parts of northern Nigeria are forested, so that makes it difficult for the drone to penetrate the cover. But nonetheless, you know, having an eye in the sky is going to be a tremendous asset for the Nigerians to the degree that the U.S. is willing to share the information that it's able to gather.
I'm wondering how symbolic this is. I mean, couldn't this be done from Virginia or Arizona? I mean, you don't necessarily need to be nearby to operate a drone capability.
You don't need to be nearby to fly it, but you do need to be nearby to have it take off and land. They don't have infinite ranges, and it's convenient to have them in the region where they can either be deployed to gather intelligence on the movements of Boko Haram or potentially elsewhere in the region. We do know that Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, continues to be active in Mali, also in southern Libya.
What of the capability that exists in Yemen would be applicable here?
Well, you know, again, just as drones do not have infinite ranges, we do not have an infinite number of drones. And there are multiple areas in which we would like to use them. And the ones that are currently being used in Yemen are dedicated to a specific fight, namely the tracking of movements of Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. But here we want to make sure that we get ahead of the curve on Boko Haram.
But in Yemen, I mean, those drones were used to actually shoot targets. I'm wondering if that is possible here and if the lessons from Yemen can be applied in a very different geographic environment in northern Nigeria.
Well, there are specific agreements that the United States government has with the Yemeni government regarding the use of armed drones, and I do not believe those agreements are in place in Africa at the moment.
So the rules of engagement would be no bang-bang from these drones, only pictures.
That's correct, and I think it's part of a new approach to counterterrorism where the United States prefers to have its partner nations at the tip of the spear, and the United States will help out in advisory capacity, intelligence capacity, and logistics capacity, and thereby we sidestep the political blowback of being engaged in the fight.
But is there a limit to what the Nigerians can actually do to act on some of this information? I mean, it's my understanding that the drone capability works best with very advanced special ops capability, like was the case in the raid that took out Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, that's correct as well. There are some units of the Nigerian military which are very capable, but the effectiveness of the intelligence gathered by the drones flying out of N'Djamena in Chad will depend to a large extent on how much intelligence is shared with the Nigerians. And there are certainly reservations in the United States about the comportment of the Nigerian military and their adherence to rules of war and the avoidance of human rights abuses.
Finally, you know, in the old days, in the Cold War days, when a conflict would would explode or begin to get tense, the first step that the U.S. military would take would be to move ships into the region. You'd get a battleship or a battleship group or maybe an Aegis cruiser moved to the region as a way of projecting force. Now it seems like the drones are the first step. Is that a change in strategy in terms of getting involved in counterterrorism?
Yes, it is. There are several drivers for that shift in strategy. The fundamental one is budgetary constraints. We just don't have the fiscal maneuverability that we had in the past. And I think we're much more cautious about how we're allocating our resources around the world. Secondly, there is, I think, political reluctance in the United States to send troops overseas. And then thirdly, this is something that we do exceptionally well.
And we'll see how that works against Boko Haram in Nigeria. Dr. Jeff Porter, assistant professor with the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point and founder of the North Africa Risk Consulting Firm, a consulting firm specializing in political and security risk in North Africa. Dr. Porter, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Is a global realignment the real story in the Ukraine crisis now? That is the question as Western leaders peruse the details in an agreement between Russia and China that would supply natural gas to China's growing economy for 30 years while giving Russia $400 billion worth of economic security to take the sting out of economic sanctions from the West. Has the Ukraine crisis revealed something bigger going on than just Crimea and eastern Ukraine? Is Europe's dependence on Russian energy suddenly a vulnerability? 70% for Germany, 100% for the Baltic nations, all members of NATO, by the way, and all being forced now to think about alternatives to Russian energy. Catherine Stoner is a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
So, Catherine Stoner, you are on record saying that by almost any measure, Russia is not a great economic power. I'm wondering, does this deal with China change that calculation in any way? Are China and Russia greater than the sum of the parts here?
No, I don't think so. Russia's not approaching China in terms of growth rate, at least not anymore. And this deal was in the works for a long time and a rather desperate necessity for Russia as we start seeing European gas markets in particular stagnate. So I don't really think this significantly changes Russia's economic position for sure.
Does it change Germany's economic position in the sense that they really need alternatives if they're going to participate fully in the sanctions regime against Russia?
About 35% of Germany's gas comes from Russia. It could be that they switch suppliers. That's actually possible with natural gas, although there are a lot of sunk costs in pipelines that Germany has participated in building from Russia to Germany. But there are alternative suppliers. Germany's the biggest importer of Russian oil, but it doesn't get all of its oil from Russia either. So Norway is another alternative. You know, there are other possibilities in terms of suppliers. I think although Germany is obviously vulnerable to Russia, Russia is vulnerable to Europe as well because it doesn't really make anything domestically. And Russian consumers have become accustomed to being able to get high quality European goods. So that's, I think the dependence runs both ways. It's interdependence, really.
And let's talk a little bit about Vladimir Putin's longstanding interest in creating some sort of Eurasian, confederation.
He calls it the Eurasian Union.
Right. And he talked a lot about, incorporating Ukraine into that. But I'm wondering if his vision does involve a closer cooperation with China on a whole range of issues besides energy.
You know, Russia and China, of course, have had a historically fraught relationship, and China could solve a lot of problems for Russia, but Russia appears unwilling to really allow it to do that. So one issue is the Chinese have a lot of labor, and Russia's population has been declining and now sort of holding steady over the last 10 years or so. So China could actually send a lot of laborers over to do jobs that Russians don't want to do in construction and so forth, or can't do. They just don't have the manpower to do it. But the Russians are not particularly welcoming of migration from China to solve that issue. And I think there are a whole bunch of reasons as to why that's the case. But for sure, it's a concern about, ethnic Russians still being dominant within their own country. It's also kind of a suspicion of foreigners working in the country. So, you know, there's hesitancy there. There is a lot of trade. Russia obviously imports a lot from China because beyond oil and gas and vodka and caviar, Russia doesn't make a whole heck of a lot that's valuable on international markets or particularly useful. At least they don't yet. They're trying. So China exports a lot of things that Russia needs and just doesn't have. It's a very, very important trade relationship, probably the most important trade relationship for Russia, for sure.
Well, that suggests then that Vladimir Putin, in trying to get some sort of cushion in dealing with Russian sanctions by making this deal with China, has actually, over the long haul, actually set himself up to being squeezed by both China and the West, in that China has gained a lot of leverage here. This is a deal that works much better for China than for Russia over the long haul.
Yeah, that's probably true, actually. When you have an economy that is dependent, or so very, very dependent on one or two things, you're naturally vulnerable. It happens to be particularly oil and gas are very valuable commodities, of course, right now, but they're also volatile, oil in particular. So the economy is vulnerable in that respect. And then to have, you know, your markets in one or two big areas makes you further vulnerable. So, you know, it runs both ways. When oil prices are high, the Russians are sitting pretty. But when oil prices dip, as they did in the 1990s, to about $17 a barrel, then, you know, they go into economic crisis. China also can get gas from other places and has been. So this gas deal was long, long in the making and isn't directly tied at all to the sanctions or the Ukraine crisis, but more that Russia was getting concerned. It needs new markets because the European market is stagnating, and the Central Asians are selling gas to the Chinese at low prices.
Want to venture a guess on what price of oil beyond which, below which, all bets are off for Putin's domestic political stability?
Yeah, so he needs the price of oil per barrel to be about $120 to keep the budget in balance.
We'll definitely watch that number, $120 a barrel. Catherine Stoner, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Catherine Stoner is a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University and author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Caution, some content of this class may be upsetting to certain students. What would you think if that warning came at the beginning of a college lecture?
Being uncomfortable, being upset, being even a little bit offended is different than having a panic attack, blacking out, hyperventilating, screaming in a classroom, feeling like you're under such physical threat, whether it's real or perceived, that you act out violently in front of other people.
Somebody needed a warning. That junior at UC Santa Barbara is not talking about math anxiety. Bailey Loverin is behind a movement to require professors include what are called trigger warnings in college courses. The idea is that certain subjects can trigger anxiety and even painful flashbacks of past traumatic experiences, images of war and crime, sexual assault, historical tragedies, intense movies. UC Santa Barbara has become the first school to mandate such trigger warnings. There are movements to add them to college courses at Oberlin, Rutgers, and some other schools, which smacks of sanitizing reality to some of you out there. Rob from Taylor, Michigan says, unless you are a young prodigy, once you've hit college, you're pretty much an adult. All graphic images should be shown because that's the world we live in. Might as well see it and hope you don't see it again. And from Miami, college is supposed to prepare a person for real life. Real life doesn't provide for trigger warnings. College students should expect a diversity of opinions and experiences without a warning. You can reach us at 877-8MYTAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Professor Ari Cohen, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska, why do this?
Well, you know, I think that sometimes it can make sense, and sometimes it could be a little bit overblown. I teach a variety of different classes here, some political philosophy, some human rights. In my human rights classes, I've always told students from the first that the material is potentially very upsetting. You know, we're dealing with torture, we're dealing with genocide, we're dealing with sexual violence. And the potential there is, I think, quite real, to be not simply disturbing, right? We all should be disturbed about those sorts of things. But because of the kind of evocative readings that I choose, the potential really exists to traumatize or re-traumatize someone who's had some experience with this sort of thing. In that sense, you know, I tell students, look, this is the class you signed up for, and this is the kind of material you're dealing with. Take care of yourself, right? Know what you're getting into. Talk to your friends, read slowly, take breaks, all of those sorts of things. And I think when you do that, it really lets students know what's coming. And because they're prepared for it, because they're taking their time, it's really led to much better discussions in class after they've done the work. But this is quite different from you know, when I teach a political philosophy course. If they're reading Plato or they're reading Nietzsche or something like that, the idea is for them to be challenged. I want to kind of shake them up. I want to ask them questions that make them really consider their previously held opinions or beliefs.
Well, I tell you, I'm very suspicious of the kind of warning label approach here, but I am familiar with some of this. I mean, I remember in high school and in college to a certain extent when – you know, really graphic Holocaust movies were shown, there were warnings, and there was, you know, an expectation that there were probably people in the class who had relatives who maybe even directly experienced some of this. And so the warnings made a lot of sense. But I do believe that if you get into this warning label approach, I mean, just it just really feels like everyone's in a padded room.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I have the same sense. And I think most professors certainly that I've talked to have that sense. We don't want to be in a position where we're sanitizing everything for them, right? So saying to students, look, we just don't think you'll be able to handle this. We're going to make that decision for you. I think that there's a real problem with that because, you know, college is a time when they're supposed to figure out, you know, what they can do and what they want to learn about and really kind of push themselves.
So what do you think of what UC Santa Barbara has done? Would you oppose that? Do you think that's fine? Do you think they have their act together here?
You know, I mean, my sense is that this has to be something that faculty are figuring out on their own. I think that if this is being mandated, I think that if it's a requirement that we have to kind of issue a blanket caution to everybody, you know, I think that the potential exists to really dumb down what we're doing in the classroom. You know, if we put these statements on our syllabi or whatever, then, you know, we'll say, okay, we're covered and we'll just do whatever we like and not worry about it. I think that's quite different from actually being mindful of the material that you're teaching and using things that are potentially upsetting or even traumatizing to teach.
I'm wondering if the fix here or if the compromise position would be, you know, urging professors to maybe know a little more about their students. I mean, some of that might be impractical in giant lecture classes, but you know, you could say, for instance, are there any students here who might have experienced war directly in Uganda, knowing that there could easily be exchange students or foreign students, immigrant students who have had experiences like that? And similarly with sexual assault, you could ask a question and, you know, encourage people to come and talk to you if they're having issues without issuing a kind of blanket warning. Knowing your students means you can craft and you know, customize your material for the class that you actually have.
Yeah, I mean, it's always helpful to get to know the students. It takes a while, obviously. And I think that, you know, saying something like, hey, if you've had something really traumatizing happen to you, come talk to me, it has its own challenges, right?
Right.
I find myself frequently telling students who come to my office, you know, hey, we're not trained for these sorts of things, right? And explicitly, we're not. We don't have mental health training or any of that sort of thing, by and large. But there are all sorts of resources on our campuses. So I do think that there is a real virtue to figuring out the composition of your classroom, but you're always – it's never going to be perfect, right? There's always the potential, completely hidden, completely unknown, that might sneak up and really catch somebody unawares. They might not even know that something is going to trigger them. I was talking with students on Facebook after I wrote this about this on my blog, and one of the students remembered an incident that from many years ago in my class that I didn't remember, where I think I was using suicide as an example in a philosophy course, and someone became very, very upset and had to leave the room. I mean, you never know what an example will trigger in somebody. And so it's hard to say, gosh, I'm speaking off the cuff, but I wonder if this might present an issue for somebody. We really don't know.
Professor Ari Cohen is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're a thousand miles away, but I still have your love to remember.
And now some thoughts about distance and the hearts of separated lovers.
Hi, my name is Mark from Orlando, Florida. My wife and I have been together for 10 years. We had a long-distance relationship for 5 of those before we ended up getting married because I was in the military and she was in college in a different state at the time. We found that to make it work, we just had to be open and honest. And so far, our relationship has been great. It doesn't show any signs of stopping.
This is Rebecca in Brooklyn. And for the past 5.5 years, I have commuted to Chicago from my home in Park Slope. I leave every Monday morning on the 6 a.m. flight out of LaGuardia and come back anywhere between Tuesday night and Thursday night. It is not easy, but my husband and my children have accommodated, and it's gotten us through a very difficult recessionary time.
You know, you guys are doing great out there. Tough circumstances challenge marriages and relationships, but when the challenge puts you out on the road, it's a different kind of challenge. 3.5 million American couples live in this commuter marriage netherworld, and some of you got in touch with us to tell us how you're hanging in there. Country musicians Jason Isbell and Amanda Shires know the musical life is a life of the road, and for Amanda, there are always questions.
I think in my mind, you know, I sometimes just ask them or say, you know, have you been talking to any women? Then some days I'm like, whatever he does, I have no control over his actions. And whatever he does or does not do, it's not a reflection on me, you know. It's the choices he makes.
That's Amanda Shires opening up about her relationship to Anna Sale in the podcast Death, Sex, and Money. We got some practical stories from you out there that suggest it doesn't always have to end badly or even end.
My name is Juhaira, and I'm calling from Miami. I had a 1-year long-distance relationship with my current boyfriend, who we've been together for 3.5 years. I was away doing my master's degree in the United Kingdom, and the way that we made it was just we acted as if I was really busy studying all the time, and then he would Skype in or be on the phone with me and help me study. I'd email him my material. He would quiz me over Skype, and then after I finished finals, he came to see me. We went on a little European tour, and then we went home together. It was nice, and we're still together.
We never let more than 8 to 10 weeks go by without one of us flying to see the other or meeting somewhere in the middle. And we also made a point to speak every evening by phone.
Great advice there from Richard in Brookline, Massachusetts. Still going strong. Here's some more advice.
Hi, my name is Wendy, calling from Portland, Oregon. My husband and I have been together for 15 years. We had a long-distance relationship for the first 4 years of our marriage while I was in vet med school. I was in Ohio. He was in California. It was probably the thing that saved our marriage through med school. And right now we have 2 children, and he is commuting during the week up to Seattle. And we're still together. We're looking forward to being all together as a family in Seattle very soon.
Well, maybe that means all together in Seattle for Dr. Wendy in Thanksgiving with the kids and I presume some very healthy animals. It's all about old-fashioned communication, you say. Dial phones and pay phones and making every minute of contact count.
Hi, my name is Kimberly. I'm from Portland, Oregon. My husband and I met in college. We did a long-distance relationship for 1.5 years before email, before cell phones. It was phone bills at 23 cents a minute and letters and occasional visits. We did that for almost 1.5 years. We finally got together and we just celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary. What we've always said is it forced us to get to know each other. It forced us to become friends, and it's been wonderful for us.
Stories from 2 Oregonians there. Keep this conversation going by posting a comment at thetakeaway.org, or you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. In November 1964, after a resounding White House victory, it was time for a confident Johnson administration to change the guard. According to records from that time, a Johnson administration official asked one of his subordinates to explain the standing policy on how to fire an employee, say, when we're certain that the employee is homosexual. Can you imagine how many lawyers would take that case today? Well, the memo that came back in response back in 1964, and that was just a few months after the Civil Rights Act was signed, said this. Because of the, quote, revulsion which homosexuality inspires in the normal person, it was common practice to, quote, lean over backwards to rule against a homosexual. Charles Francis, president of the Mattachine Society of Washington, obtained that memo and others through public record requests. Charles Francis joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, John.
So, Charles, what do these memos show a pattern of in Washington, D.C. in 1964 and really for quite a while afterwards?
Well, they show a pattern of really disturbing animus. This memo talking about revulsion is really sort of drenched in bigotry and homophobia behind the scenes. This memo wasn't meant to be read by outsiders. It was an internal communication inside saying, what do we do with gays that we don't know if they're rehabilitated or not?
And according to your investigation, it really stuck around. That memo had some force of authority for as much as a decade.
Yeah, a decade and beyond. It was the philosophy that gays were immoral and what they said, unsuitable for federal employment because of the revulsion factor and also the problem of having people work with a known deviant. And this is the kind of stuff we're finding inside the National Archives.
And explain the origins of the name Mattachine Society of Washington. It really goes back to the early history of gay activism.
Yeah, it does. In 1951, a guy named Harry Hay formed the original Mattachine Society. And they used that word Mattachine because it referred to the masked court jesters in medieval times that would have to wear a mask in order to speak truth to the king. So they adopted that in the old days. And in 1961, Frank Kameny, the civil rights pioneer here in Washington, D.C., started his own Mattachine Society of Washington to make his case for gay civil equality for decades here in Washington.
In this National Archives investigation, have you found memos like this and this level of bigotry at all levels in the government, Congress, the FBI?
Yeah, yes, we do. We found a whole series of memoranda put out and pushed by J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, and this was called his Sex Deviates Program. And these memoranda show Hoover having plants in every branch of the government and every government office reporting back to him and the FBI who were the suspected deviates so that they could investigate these deviates and fire them. And we also found that J. Edgar Hoover had a sex deviant contact inside the Supreme Court building itself to report back to him on suspected deviates in the judiciary.
And, you know, part of this smacks of just pure intolerance and bigotry, and part of it is a set of obsessions that's associated with the culture of the 1950s and 60s. It's sort of two different dynamics here.
Yeah, it is. It arose out of conflating gay Americans with treason or disloyalty, and that triggered President Eisenhower to signing an executive order. It was called Executive Order 10450, which was a cataclysm for gay Americans, gay and lesbian Americans, for decades to come because it put the word sexual perversion in the government security regulations. It was part of a gay sex panic and a communist panic in the country right after World War II.
You know, the language of these memos is really astounding. The memo that we referred to in the introduction to this segment also includes the homespun theory, once a homo, always a homo, speaking about employees and how they're to be dealt with, referencing this rehabilitation idea that you talked about.
Yeah, it was a very old school insult, once a homo, always a homo. And it's really exciting, actually, that we find this kind of stuff so that we can point out to people that this discrimination goes way back. It's rooted in bigotry, and we're dealing with it even today with this non-discrimination proposal for federal contractors. People are asking President Obama to sign an executive order now to put an end to this once a homo, always a homo mindset that's existed in the federal government for too long.
Is it possible that eventually, when you get to the end of this investigation, that the National Archives will also tell the story of how this changed, of how this bigotry was put aside and actual protections were put in place in the workplace?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. At our event last night at the McDermott Law Firm, David Ferriero, the archivist himself, the head of the National Archives, talked about how they were moving forward to develop a system-wide gay finding aid to index and help us find these stories and this information at the archives. And you got to realize they also run the 17 presidential libraries. So everything from the Reagan to the Clinton to the Bush to the Harry Truman, all of these presidential libraries have tremendous resources to search for this kind of history, the long-deleted gay political history of our country.
Charles Francis is president of the Mattachine Society of Washington, D.C., searching through the archives to tell a story of social change in the United States. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you.
Coming up, why Republican Dr. Ben Carson says the math doesn't add up on gay marriage.
It's sort of like a new group of mathematicians comes along. They say 2 + 2 = 5. And the traditionalists say, no, it's 4. It's always been 4. And the new ones say, no, it has to be 5 for you, too. And if it's not 5 for you, then you're a mathophobe.
More from conservative Ben Carson and whether he's setting his sights on 2016 coming up. One of those obtuse truisms in American democracy that the way you run for president is to first say you are not running. Hillary Clinton, not running, right? Jeb Bush, not running, right? Then you create a narrative something like, the American people signaled to me that this was an important moment, the country needs me, I'm being urged to run, the pressure was intense, my family said they would support me, and so I have decided, blah, 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 exploratory committee, and then the campaign kicks off. Well, with more than 2 years until the 2016 presidential election, there are a lot of people who fit this bill. One of them is Dr. Ben Carson, a retired neurosurgeon from Johns Hopkins, who made a name for himself in his speech at the 2013 National Prayer Breakfast, you may remember, when he attacked the left for high taxes, political correctness, and the Affordable Care Act, with the president sitting just a few feet away. Dr. Carson elaborates on some of his ideas in that speech in his campaign manifesto new book, One Nation: What We Can All Do to Save America's Future. But to be clear, Dr. Ben Carson told us he's not running.
As you know, there are a lot of people who think that I should run for president. That was not in my bucket list of things to do. But what I'm finding all over the country are people who seem to be gravitating toward me because I'm talking a lot about things that make sense. One of the key things and one of the real points of the book One Nation is that we, the American people, are not each other's enemies. And yet, you know, we're being divided up into all kinds of groups by people who do a lot of manipulation. You know, there's wars on gender and age, race, income, you know, virtually anything that you can think of. And this is not how we became a great nation.
Part of that argument is the logic that was used by the Supreme Court in striking down the Defense of Marriage Act in the Supreme Court case on same-sex marriage. Would you seek to have a constitutional amendment to keep same-sex marriage from being legal in the United States if you were president?
If I were president, obviously I would uphold the laws of the land, whatever they are, regardless of my own personal beliefs.
So you support the legalization of same-sex marriage?
I support the law of the land. I always support the law of the land.
Right, but now, the law of the land gets approved by people who vote for or against laws.
Now, what I will say, as far as marriage is concerned, the definition of marriage has been between a man and a woman for not only centuries, but for millenniums. And The question really is, does anyone have the right to change the definition? And if they do have the right to change the definition, are they the only ones with the right to change the definition? Or does someone else get to change the definition down the road because they changed the definition? And what we really need to start looking at are bigger picture issues. Do any two human beings, adults, have the right to join themselves together in a legal relationship? Of course they do. And I think that is the real issue. Can they do that? Absolutely they can do that.
Why is it such a leap for them to call it marriage?
Because if we change it for one group, we have to keep changing it. If you can tell me that we change it this one time and we never change it again, I would like to hear your argument for that.
Well, you know, things change all the time. I mean, a lot of things happening millennia ago don't happen anymore, you know, human sacrifice. You know,
so you admit that if you change it, now you have to keep changing it, right?
Things change all the time.
So why go through all the grief of changing it when you can create another situation for them that solves the problem? Why is it that they have to change it for everybody else? You know, it's sort of like a new group of mathematicians comes along. They say 2 + 2 = 5. And the traditionalists say, no, it's 4. It's always been 4. And the new ones say, we insist that it's 5. And so the traditionalists say, okay, it can be 5 for you, but we're keeping it as 4. And the new ones say, no, it has to be 5 for you too. And if it's not 5 for you, then you're a mathophobe.
Well, I would say that your analogy that 2 + 2 = 5 suggests that homosexuality is unnatural in some way, and that's the kind of thing that got you in trouble before
when you
compared it to bestiality.
It suggests that it changes, and I did not compare it to bestiality. Never did I say it was the same as bestiality, and it's a little bit irritating to me that people grab things that you say and try to change the definition in order to stir up the very thing that I was talking about.
Well, you addressed in your book that you regretted making that comparison or that list, that statement.
I regret that people took it that way, but that obviously wasn't what I meant.
No one would argue that Barack Obama being the first African-American president is a historical milestone in the narrative of the USA. What do you think would be the historical significance of, if you were in the White House, being the second African-American president?
As far as I'm concerned, it has no historical significance. And I am very anxious for the time when people don't consider a person's color. You know, I was asked once when I was doing an NPR interview, Dr. Carson, you don't talk about race very often. Why is that? And I said, it's because I'm a neurosurgeon. And she looked at me quizzically, and I said, you see, when I take someone to the operating room and I cut that scalp and peel it back and take off that bone flap and open the dura, I'm operating on the thing that makes that person the person who they are. The skin doesn't make them who they are. And, you know, we just need to stop the whole thing about a person's color. You know, one of the things that irritates me more than anything are all of those people who say, but you're black, therefore you have to think this way. Black people have the ability to think independently also, or at least they should.
Are you familiar with these comedians, Key and Peele?
No.
You know, they do a routine that pokes fun at black Republicans, that they're a very small group, and they are very defensive about diversity within their group and that they all think very, very independently. And it's something of a running joke, at least it seems, among mainstream African-Americans that there is this small group of very defensive Republican African-Americans. What do you think about that idea? And what do you think about the idea of the African-American message being conservative?
I wonder if their ridicule extends to Booker T. Washington, who was a Republican, and George Washington Carver, who was a Republican, and Frederick Douglass, who was a Republican, the father of Dr. Martin Luther King, who was a Republican, and the list goes on and on.
A very different GOP, though, declaring emancipation back in the 1860s.
Well, I mean, the Democratic Party is very different, too. I mean, take somebody like John Kennedy saying the things that he was saying, he would be considered a right-wing Republican. Now, they'd probably tar and feather him if he went to a Democrat convention talking about, that's not what your country can do for you, that's what you can do for your country. I mean, so, you know, the whole spectrum has shifted.
Neurosurgeons really perform miracles with a scalpel, why would you ever want to be president? That's going to make neurosurgery look like a cakewalk.
Well, I don't want to be president. That's why would anybody want to be president? But considering the condition of our nation, if a large number of my fellow citizens felt that that was something that they really desired, and I would hope, you know, that I could make a difference in that capacity.
Ben Carson is a retired neurosurgeon and author of One Nation, What We Can All Do to Save America's Future. Carson also talked with us about his problems with the Affordable Care Act. He is a doctor, after all.
The most important thing that a person has is their health and their health care. And that should be in their hands, not in the hands of someone else. That is fundamentally oppositional to the whole concept of freedom.
You can hear the extended interview and a bit of a feisty debate. Visit our website at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. Recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com.